It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Keep telling me don't hang around. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. Then I go to my brother. Say, brother, help me please. But he winds up knocking me back down on my knees. Lord, there have been times that I thought I could last for long. But I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes it will.
Okay, and good morning to everyone. Welcome to another edition of Quest Youth Radio, which is the best youth radio. I started out with the music of Sam Cooke, A Change Is Gonna Come, and surely transitioning to Wake Up Everybody. And surely our attempt every week, each and every week, is to help promote change and informational content from an historical perspective. So I've just talked too long already.
So let me start out by introducing everyone to our guest, our first guest. I just want you to say good morning is Justin Hill. Good morning, Justin.
Good morning, everybody.
All right. And
straight on to Mr. Shelton Harris. Good morning, Mr. Harris.
Good morning.
All right. And our next student host, who's going to start out our show once I finish the intro, is, oh yeah, everyone, happy birthday to Walter Pierce. Good morning, Walter.
Good morning. Good morning.
All right. And we have Kenesha Gardner. Good morning.
Hey. Good morning, everybody. Happy birthday, Walter.
Okay. And Tamar Davis, our black librarian. It's always a pleasure to have you. Say good morning.
Good morning, everybody.
Okay.
Okay, it sounds good. Everybody's in good, positive spirit.
Now, I just want to start out by saying when I, you know, originally put this together, I wrote it, and I looked at the segments that we produce every week, and I came up with a little bit of something like this. And it goes, and you've heard it before, music, like poetry, has a method. And history, like a diamond, shines clear to the truth. You see, words have meaning that we can comprehend, like definitions. And news can show us a chain of events that we may not always understand. Now, I'm asking you to pull back our musical curtain to see and hear the contributions of our diaspora. And you're sure to find our Quest moment, where we attempt to make waves, indeed, Quest community vibration. So thank you once again for joining us to hear a different perspective of our community. Our student host turned the page this morning for another informational and historical broadcast, and we invite you to enjoy. Sit back. And now I turn it over to the birthday young man, Mr. Walter Pierce.
Thank you for that. And see, history is like a diamond. Each prism represents the work of a group of people at a particular period of time. Look into the diamond and see the reflections of the past self, the pain of your mother, the choice of your father, and the blood of your ancestors. Look deeply and you are bound to find yourself. Now, my diamond segment for this week is on Mrs. Ever Williams. And see, she is a native of Vicksburg, Mississippi, and was an honor student at Alcorn A&M College in Lawrence, Mississippi, where she met and married the outstanding student, Megar Evers. They moved to the historic Mount Bayou, Mississippi, where they embarked on a business career with Mangolia Mutual Life Insurance Company. Business responsibilities demanded extensive travel in the Delta, where they witnessed the burden of poverty and injustice imposed on their people. Determined to make a positive change in that society, both Megar and Murrow opened and managed the first NAACP, Mississippi State Office. They lived under constant threats as the work for voting rights, economic stability, fair housing, equal education, equal justice, and dignity. The couple's high-profile activism work included investigating lynchings and organizing boycotts, made them a target for racist detractors. After several attempts on his life, Megar Evers shot and killed after coming home from work in June of 1963. The Ku Klux Klan member who killed him, Byron D. LeBeckwith, was tried twice from an all-white jury, but of course, he was not guilty. Evers Williams would finally see justice for her husband's murder 3 decades later, when D. LeBeckwith was found guilty and sent to prison when he was in his 70s. In the 1990s, Merrill Evers Williams joined the NAACP Board of Directors, and in 1995 ran for chair of the board. At the time, the organization was experiencing a financial squeeze. Evers Williams spearheaded the efforts to put NAACP on firm financial footing. Saying she had successfully completed her mission, she stepped down after 3 years and turned her efforts to establishing the Medgar Evers Institute to preserve her husband's legacy in Jackson, Mississippi. Evers has received many other honors over the course of her life, including seven honorary doctorates. She was named Woman of the Year in 1998 by Myth Magazine and Ebony Magazine, named her the 100 most fascinating black women of the 20th century. Whoopi Goldberg played Evers Williams in the 1996 film Ghost of Mississippi, based on Medgar Evers' murder in the 1994 trial that brought his murderer to justice. In January of 2013, Evers Williams delivered the invocation at Barack Obama's second presidential inauguration, becoming the first woman and first non-clergy member to perform the prayer. And that concludes my segment on Myrna Evers Williams. And again, this is the wife of Medgar Evers. And as you can see here, she has put a lot of work and time into being able to seek justice for her husband, Medgar Evers, and also putting in time and effort into helping out her people, African Americans. Again, I thank you for listening. This is student host Walter Pierce on 89.5 WSOU.
Be remiss if I did not open up a discussion of our panel and allow them to basically have an input of comments in any way they see fit. Now, I'm going to start out with Mr. Shelton Harris. Mr. Harris, Medgar Evers' wife, Medgar Evers' life, he dedicated his life for voter registration to make a difference in. You know, it seems that we live in a world where apathy seems to be the story of the day for many people who say that, you know, actually getting out and voting doesn't make a difference. But here's a gentleman who was assassinated, murdered in front of his house, right, with his family inside the house, basically trying to make a difference to get people to register to vote. And apparently he was seen as a threat and taken out. What is your comment to his wife and her work and his work? What are your thoughts? Mr. Harris. Good morning again.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, when it comes down to the life of, I guess we're talking about his wife, Merle Evers, you know, she was always a part of the called civil rights movement and stuff in Mississippi. And just the fact that we're talking about Mississippi says a lot about the violence and stuff and the people who weren't really trying to see change as readily as other places around the country. You know, and the fact that after her husband's death, she continued to do stuff like that says a lot about her as an individual. And what people seem to fail to realize that most of the time, it is the females in the struggle that really take the brunt of a lot of the vanguard, because the males are readily killed. Where the females, they might not be killed as readily, but they'll get to say and move in different places where men can't. You know, so she was using her position to do the things that helps in the broader sense. And, you know, big up to her, because she's definitely lived a long life after all that turmoil she had as a younger woman.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your input. We're going to go to Tanisha. Tanisha Gardner, what are your thoughts on Mega Ever's wife in this particular segment?
Shoot, she's powerful. That's a powerful black woman. And especially she shows the power that all black women have, that we have within ourselves to always push. Because that's crazy to see your husband getting killed, you know, for fighting for justices that's supposed to be as a human being. And for her to keep that legacy alive is very important, and to keep that fight going, even though it took that many years for justice to happen, just the simple fact that she kept on pushing, it shows a lot about her integrity, her character, her morals, and her belief with, you know, within God and within herself. And we need to take some of those principles and, you know, put it within our own lives and fight for, you know, what we need as a family to keep our families going. That's what I would say to that.
Okay, thank you so much. Now, I'm going to go to our black librarian. And, Tamar, basically, I need you to kind of make a comment, but I need you to simplify it so that a Justin Hill student host can digest and understand what we're talking about here.
I'm sorry, I was on mute.
Yes.
After 30 years of, for three decades of ongoing commitment and fighting for her husband's death and his demise due to Byron Beckwith for 30 years in reality of unconditional segregation in the South, for a woman to do that and to move forward to make sure that justice will serve. It explains itself. It's unconditional commitment, relentless in her efforts despite all of the adversity of the racism. I'm quite sure that she went through law enforcement officials and police law enforcement officials being harassed and legal counsel or the people in the legal profession actually trying to not make sure that that moved forward like the way it did. But she was unconditionally committed and made sure after three decades justice was served. And in addition to having the steadfastness to become part of the NAACP, and while she was chaired the NAACP in her region, after she actually done everything that was needed, she said she can step down now because her mission is complete and now the NAACP can move forward. As a woman, and I believe in a matrilineal system, so I believe that all women are powerful, but as a woman to stand up to that sense of intense adversity is phenomenal. And she's a queen of my eyes forevermore. So she did a lot of great work, and she's consistently involved with making sure she can move America forward. So kudos to her and what she has done.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your input. We're going to be coming back to our panelists. And right now we're going to continue musically. And when we return, Justin Hill will be defining the word ancestor. And so we're going to take a look into that and hear what he has to say. Okay, we're back, and I'd like for Walter, please introduce Justin for us.
Yes, for our next segment of today, I want to introduce no other than Mr. Justin Hill.
Good morning, everybody. Again, this is Justin Hill, and like Mr. Bay said, my definition will be on the word ancestor. This segment provides the listener with the words and their meanings so that we can achieve together a common basis to say we care and we believe in ourselves. Remember, whosoever controls our definitions controls us. We must define existence and not have it defined for us. And an ancestor is one from whom a person is descended and who is usually more remote in the line of descent than a grandparent of a more recent or existing species or group. And that concludes my segment on definitions. I am student host Justin Hill on WSOU.
Okay, Justin, as always, you just don't get off the hook that easy. You were able to give us the definition. But what does ancestor mean to you? What was your reason for doing this particular word?
Well, the word ancestor to me means, like, when you have family members and they, like, passed away. And that's really what it means to me.
Okay. Let's get Mr. Harris in here to help you out. Mr. Harris, can you elaborate a little bit on ancestry and its importance?
All right. Now, ancestry and ancestors are kind of like two different things. But
okay.
Justin was talking about ancestors. And, you know, and they're just really like your forebears, the people that came before you. And the length of time before you goes back millennia. So an ancestor could be anybody that was a part of making you who you are today. Because the DNA in your ancestors, some of that same DNA is within you today. And, you know, and it takes a lot of people, as far back as you go, it takes a lot of people to make you as an individual. That's why everybody is unique. And understanding your ancestors' history or who your ancestors were, I believe gives you a better understanding of who you are and the things that you need to do to become a good ancestor when it's your turn.
Thank you. And so we're going to go to Tanisha Garner. You have a do you have a comment about the definition ancestor? And then I'm going to come to the Black Librarian right after you, Tanisha. Good morning again. Do you have a comment on ancestor?
Good morning, everybody. Yeah, ancestors is very powerful. It's about knowing your legacy, knowing your history, knowing what gifts that you have, you know, that trickles down through generation and generation. And it's very important that we hone into it. And I think, I guess within, you know, a lot of families, especially in, you know, certain urban areas, we forget about our legacy and how our ancestors fought for us and how we worked collectively as a team. I don't know. It's like sometimes when you think about ancestry, you might think of a disconnection because you're not part of that bloodline. But just imagine the families that was married into those bloodlines. That's what made it powerful because it was about, you know, wealth. And imagine if we, you know, thought of that, you know, about ourselves now of how we can start shifting the dynamics of what we deem our families to be or, you know, or our friends to be or many people around us to be able to change that narrative to start looking into what our ancestors did on abroad to be able to create a better way of life.
Thank you so much. And Justin, I hope you're taking notes and paying attention. I'm coming to the Black Librarian. The word ancestor, help Justin Hill understand it a little bit more.
Sure. Great job, Justin. I see you. I see the future now, seeing a good brother doing what you do. Appreciate you. Ancestor basically means a progenitor or the original, the first, the forefathers, somebody that comes before you. So in most instances, if you look at Ancestry.com, which is a great platform to use to actually see some of the progenitors, your family members, and do a genealogical study. In fact, I'm doing one now for my family, and I trace my family as far back as 1808 through Ancestry. Ancestors are very important. Sometimes it's not just in terms of wealth and money, but sometimes you be like, well, where do I get my nose from or my ears and my eyes? And, you know, you begin to see understand the biological impact of, okay, I'm short, but my father's tall, or my father's, I'm light complected, I'm this, I'm that. So it's a whole lot, not just the history, but it's a biological record of of you and your family and their impact and what was done historically and so on and so forth, stuff like that. So the whole lot to ancestors and ancestry. Sometimes, you know, like my son who's taller than me looks just like me, but he's taller than me because his mother's tall. So there's a lot to ancestry, and it's a lot of great history to it. And I'm continuing to do my genealogical study. I have a lot of information here I'm working on now. But ancestry is very important, and knowing your ancestors and knowing who was first is extremely important. Thanks.
Okay. So thank you so much. And, you know, I just want to make the audience aware that our panel is not with us when we actually do and perform the live broadcast every Saturday morning from Seton Hall University. And this is why I want to give them a platform today and every Sunday, so that they can give these young student hosts can carry that into the next live broadcast. But I need to make a comment, and it's basically pertaining to something that I've seen various people online post, and that is we don't have family reunions no more. We don't conjole or be with our cousins and our aunts. There seems to be a difference in how we get along socially with our family members. Where are the family reunions? Where are the cousins? Where is the family in all of this? Because when you talk about ancestors, you know, they can be living as well. You know, your cousin. I remember my mom went to a family reunion. And I'm big on family reunions, but this was one that I didn't go to. And she brought back a live stream that was put together and produced online of our family lineage. And when I started looking at the pictures, it was just so amazing that I saw so many people that looked like me. and I can see my ancestry, I can see the DNA, I can see how I came about looking the way I did. Mind you, we all are part of the human race, and we all have a gobbledanger or someone who looks like us somewhere. But let's see. Now, don't all jump at once. I'll pick on one of the young people on the panel. Walter, what do you think about family reunions and being together with family?
It's very important, I would say, because, you know, family is, you know, most important bond you have. You know, you got your blood, that's who you're most closest with. So having family reunions and being able to see, you know, most of the people in your family all together, you know, it's an unforgettable time, and you'll remember that for a long time.
Absolutely. I come from a family. Well, you know, we all have two sides of the family. Tamir, I'm coming back to you, man. You know, my family, they were quick to pick up people, you know, that I knew for sure wasn't part of the family, but they just made them family, you know. They just, I don't know. You know, well, that's your cousin. No, that's not my cousin. Yeah, well, it is now. What do you think about that?
I don't know. It's complicated, you know. It's just complicated.
What do you think about family reunions and just being together as a family?
Well, it's a lot of us try family reunions, but again, a lot of stuff come out in family reunions too. But you still need to relate and communicate as much as possible to know who your cousins and your distant cousins and so and so forth. I've just had a family reunion in North Carolina sometime, and in South Carolina, what was it, 3 or 4 years ago. And I met my great-great aunt. And it was very, very interesting. But we sure have to make an attempt to make it work. But she's about 97 now. But we're making it work as best as possible. Families can be family situation can be complex because of, there's a lot of history there, but we still, it's still important to sort through it and deal with it as best as possible.
Okay. I'm going to let you off the hook right there, and I'm going to jump on to you're welcome. Mr. Harris, if I say to you, I don't believe that there's such a thing as a dysfunctional family, what would be your response?
You haven't read too many books or seen too many things. No, but as far as dysfunctional, you know, that can really be taken in context. You know, people can call you dysfunctional because you don't act like everybody else. And okay, maybe something's wrong with you. But if something works for you, that's fine. You know, like the TV show The Addams Family. Outside of the Addams Family, you would have thought something's wrong with those folks. But within their family context, everything was wonderful. So, you know, dysfunction is something that you have to see from the outside, not from the inside.
Okay. All right. Kenesha, would you like to chime in on family reunion or any of the discussion that's going on at hand?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was trying to take myself off the mute. Yeah, I guess about the dysfunctional part. Sometimes you got to,
well,
as they
part.
Say, dinner. I guess about the dysfunctional part. I guess I would stay on that part. Is some people might call it generational curses or generational stagnation. So when it comes to those part in your lives, I believe like the next generation has to see where those pitfalls was at to be able to change the course of their legacy and their history.
Mm. Thank you for bringing this into perspective and putting a serious note to this particular discussion, which is very important for us not to forget our ancestry, who our ancestors are, right? And with that being said, we're going to take a quick break, music break, and come right back. Don't you go anywhere. Okay. So welcome back. I'd like to hand it back over to Walter Pierce so that you can introduce Justin Hill for his diamond segment.
Please take it away.
Thank you. And now coming up with their diamond segment, I would like to introduce Mr. Justin Hill.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm student host Justin Hill. And for my diamond segment, it will be on Toni Morrison. History is like a diamond. Each prism represents the work of a group of people at a particular period of time. Look into the diamond and see the reflections of your past self, the pain of your mother, the choice of your father, and the blood of your ancestors. Look deeply and you are bound to find yourself. And Toni Morrison was born February 18, 1931. And she was an American novelist. Her first novel was called The Bluest Eye, and it was published in 1970. The critically acclaimed Song of Solomon brought her national attention and won the National Book Critics Circle Award. And in 1988, Morrison won the Pulitzer Prize for Beloved. 1987, she was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1973. Also, the National Endowment for the Humanities selected Morrison for the Jefferson Lecture, the U.S. federal government's highest honor for the achievement in the humanities in 1996. She was honored with the National Book Foundation's Medal and Distinguished Contribution to American Letters the same year. And that concludes my segment on diamonds. I thank you all for listening.
Okay, so that word is Pulitzer. I always had a problem with that Pulitzer word. It's an award. Justin, I'd like for you to introduce now, please, our birthday boy, who's now a young man. Justin, please introduce Walter Pierce for his segment of definition.
Yes, now we have our birthday boy student host, Walter Pierce, who is doing his definition segment.
Thank you for that introduction. And now, you see, it is time for definition. And this segment provides the listener with words and their meaning so that we can achieve together a common basis to say we care and we believe in ourselves. Remember, whosoever controls our definitions controls us. We must define existence and not have it defined for us. And my definition for this week is the Fair Housing Act. And the Fair Housing Act protects people from discrimination when they are renting or buying a home, getting a mortgage, seeking housing assistance, or engaging in other housing-related activities. Now, a little bit of history about, you know, the Fair Housing Act and why this is even in place. Now, see, on April 11th, 1968, President Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act of 1968, which it was meant as a follow-up to the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The 1968 Act expanded on previous acts and prohibited discrimination concerning the sale, rental, and financial of housing based on race, religion, nationality, origin, or sex, and also handicap and family status. Now, you know, the reason this was even put into place was, if you go back even before those times where, you know, African Americans or minorities will move into certain communities, let's say a white majority community, what will usually happen is all of the properties in that neighborhood when African Americans or others move into the neighborhood, the properties would depreciate, and a family's house would start to lose value. So this will cause an uproar to white people in America, and, you know, they will start moving out of these neighborhoods. They will start basically trying to run out of the neighborhood they moved in so that their property cannot depreciate. And they will also try to not even sell the house to African Americans. They will try everything in their power to make it seem like, you know, this is not a good place for them to live. They shouldn't live here, all of that, so they don't move in. So all of these factors really contributed to the Fair Housing Act, and it was something that was needed so that there could be African Americans moving wherever they wanted to live and not being discriminated against. So thank you for listening to my segment on the Fair Housing Act. This is student host Walter Pierce on 89.5 WSOU.
Okay. For time purposes, I'd like to bring in our black librarian and to give us a historical perspective on fair housing. Take it away. I know that you're taking a moment to take yourself off of mute. Tamir Davis.
Hello. The term that I would like to use is redlining. Redlining was a very integral part of institutional racism that existed in this country during the slaveocracy of America, after the slaveocracy of America, and still to this day, whereby there was actually written laws in certain municipalities throughout New Jersey and throughout the country whereby it was stated that blacks are not permitted to move in these particular areas. If you look at the area, the city of Wayne and other places in New Jersey, they're not permitted to move in these areas. They're only permitted to actually coming as maids, domestic servants, so on and so forth, stuff like that. And it's in the books. And it's not just here in New Jersey, it's been different parts of the country. And then when we look at, when we begin to look at housing projects like HUD, so on and so forth, HUD wasn't just for predominantly black people, or projects wasn't for predominantly blacks or people, that demographic. They were for soldiers coming home from the war, and a lot of them needed to have a place to stay. That's where you have the Barclay area, the Prudential Homes, actually was here prior to a lot of the construction periods of major housing projects throughout the country. So before, you've seen a lot of African Americans moving in Cellarite homes and so on and so forth. And, you know, I'm saying this because it's immediate. You've seen a lot of whites living in the area, and it was a different sense of what was going on during that time. I think what happens is the wear down on a lot of the major housing projects throughout the country is that Huron pipeline bomb that actually impacted on the social structure, because a lot of people were getting high and a lot of people were involved in a lot of street activity during that particular time. But originally, it was for soldiers coming home who actually were a part of the war, and they wanted to have to come home to a place to stay and so on and so forth, stuff like that. So the whole notion that originally when blacks were moving in and moving in particular housing projects, that there was no sense of decorum and so on, that's a farce. That's not completely true, because there was order in a lot of these housing projects. There were a lot of people cleaning the whole hallways. There was a lot of sense of respect and a lot of great sense of ethics. You had the solo house. You had a lot of different things happening in the black community during that particular time. But the reality is, if you want to go back and look at the institutional racism, was codified in city ordinance throughout the country whereby blacks couldn't originally move in to certain areas. That's a fact. Thank you.
Okay. All right. No, thank you, right, for that historical perspective on the reality of fair housing. Now, I'm going to give you a couple of minutes. Tanisha Gardner, take it away. Fair housing, what do you think? What are your comments?
Yeah, definitely. I just want to follow up what Tamir was saying. So basically he was talking about, it was called the Federal Housing Administration at that time. is when they built, like you were saying, because out of the World War II, the reason why they built it because they were, you know, working on the different manufacturing for the war, and it was called the Center of Defense Production. And then once, I guess, it started to, you know, wane down after the war, then I guess they thought that the African Americans were going to go back down south, which that didn't happen, and they built, I guess, more secure housing for the white population. And then it trickled into the Federal Housing Administration, which actually gave money, funding to build 17,000 homes, which created suburban, the suburban area. And what happened in the urban area, they did not put money back in that community, because at that time, when they did have HUD or those buildings, it wasn't subsidized at that time because they was working. And when they realized once those jobs left that that particular area, that's when everything started to decline. And like Tamir was saying, how the influx of drugs came into play and how there have never been resources now. And especially when you look at HUD right now at this moment, when you look at Newark Housing Authority, a lot of their developments, they are not building for low income. They are demolishing it and replacing it with affordable housing. But when you say affordable housing, affordable from whom? And then with the job market, are they really reaching those plateaus? And then you also have to look at the disparity of wealth. And it's saying when they did have those homes, and those homes at that time, you know, the price changes. So you're going from $10,000 to now at this time, the house is worth $300,000, so that all automatically creates equity for you. So you could put, like, say, if you want to take out another mortgage, you'd be able to have assets to it. And where our lack is with the 10% black wealth lack versus the 60% white wealth gap, that's why we are such in a place that we are right now.
I'm going to take it away from you there. And I'm going to allow Mr. Harris. Mr. Harris, you only have 1 minute, but I want to say that 60% of the wealth, the wealthiest people in America, have received their wealth from either inheritance or just being born into the family with social connections to establish them as wealthy. Redlining, take it away.
Yeah, just like Tanisha and Tamir were saying, you know, this was something that was originally set up to benefit the, we'll call them the dominant society. And then when the when circumstances changed, you know, because personally, I remember I used to live on Court Street back when Howard Street was still had buildings before there were projects. And when those projects were first built, people couldn't wait to get into those places. They were brand new. The elevators worked. The like Tamir was saying, the hallways was cleaned up by the people that lived in there. They weren't desolate places for people to be in. But the situations around the society at the time helped build that. And we're really not like that normally. I know I only had a minute.
Okay. All right. I'm going to continue because we are definitely running out of time, but definitely good topics to table for the moment as we transition. And I'm coming back to Walter Pierce, and I'm going to give the introduction for our next segment of Curtains, which is an exposure and analysis artists and their work behind the curtains of the stage. You see, many performing artists have grown rich from the community. But Curtains is our segment where we talk about what they have given back to the community. Curtains is a review of the musical growth and history and the impact of particular style and genius on the general moods and attitudes of the listening audience. It is musical and lyrical and consciousness and presented by an artist and his work. And now, without any further ado, I turn it back over to you, Walter Pierce. Take it away.
Yes, no problem. And my curtain segment for this week is on Lionel Richie. And see, Born and raised in Tuskegee, Alabama, Lionel Richie's music is woven in the fabric of the international song, with records ranging from pop country and funk to gospel and classical. A rebel who defies classification, Lionel Richie has sold hundreds of millions of albums worldwide, celebrated for such hits as Endless Love, Hello, and We Are the World. Lionel's music spans both decades and genres. With an Oscar, a Golden Globe, 4 Grammy Awards, and countless other distinctions to his name, Lionel Richie has become an American icon as much for his music as his humanitarianism. Always giving back to his fans and communities worldwide, Richie understands the importance of philanthropy and the power of collaboration. In 1985, Richie co-founded USA Africa in response to a tragic famine wreaking havoc in Africa. This effort brought together some of the biggest names in music to create what was and still is a worldwide phenomenon. The record of the original We Are the World sold more than 7 million records worldwide and raised in excess of $60 million to address critical needs among Africans affected by famine. And that concludes what I have for Lionel Richie. Again, a man of the people who wants just to use his musical influence to help others out there. Thank you.
Walter, I'd like for you to take this moment to close out the show.
I want to thank everybody for another edition of Quest. Everybody 85.5 from the campus of Seton Hall in South Thorn. Quest Youth Radio is the best,
the best youth radio.
Fiesta forever. Come on and sing along. Let the music play on, play on, play on. Feel it in your heart and feel it in your soul. Let the music take control. We're going to party, climbing, fiesta, forever. Come on and sing along. We're going to party, climbing, fiesta, forever. Come on and sing my song.